This is Jim Petrosini. Welcome to the Folksville Podcast. In our series of joint podcasts with Dr. Marv Langston and smartfutures.org, we'd like to introduce Junaid Islam in our number five podcast. Junaid will discuss the technology area of 5G and how security architecture has a new role. Junaid will also discuss the impact of the zero trust model.
Junaid, and thank you very much for honoring us by joining us today. Junaid and I have worked together for several years, although I didn't know him in his early career, but he's one of our national heroes that has taken care of special networks for the nation for decades now. And he's willing to share his new knowledge about 5G and how that relates to zero trust. And so why don't Junaid give us a little bit of back here about your background so people can understand that better, and then we can get into the subject.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on this call. So I've been involved in secure communications, and I've just realized now 30 years, probably 32 years. I graduated in 1989. I got hired by the U.S. government, specifically the national security team, right out of school. In fact, I actually had not left the university. Somebody hired me as I was walking down the hallway, and I should warn anybody who goes through that, never take a job from somebody you don't know as you're walking. But as the United States was deploying its first set of secure comms around the world, I was involved in really as an installer, and that's how I started. And I have to give a lot of credit to the people who hired me, because not only did they train me a lot in a lot of advanced secure comms techniques, but then they also trusted me to do the work. And I supported US personnel around the world in combat missions and counterterrorism missions, not as a fighter, but as an installer. After that, I went to a safer career path. I started developing network protocols, or actually I'm suspicious they put me in that job just to, like, you know, have me sit behind a desk, but I helped create MLPP, which is still used today in weapons control systems. So that red launch button, there's a protocol for that. And I created the frame relay prioritization scheme. That would have been, a little bit later, 1995. Then I did MPLS routing at Cisco. I did the buffer and queue management. After that, I got hired by NetCentric Warfare, the people who knew me right at the beginning of my career. And I worked on mobile IPv6, which became a part of 5G. Then after that, actually got hired by the U.S. intelligence community to work on access control for C2S, which became a part of NIST 800-207 Zero Trust. And I've been doing this a long time, kind of sad, same job for the last 32 years, but I'm happy to be here and share any, answer any questions you want.
Well, we're glad to see you got onto the forensic cyber side of it before the cartel guys found out about you.
So as you know, there's a lot happening in cybersecurity, in 5G and zero trust, and look forward to this conversation.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing in 5G and why you're so concerned about the cybersecurity. I know you have a lot of concerns about where we're going and where it might lead us in terms of vulnerability. And I know that ties back into your zero trust background. So just explain that a little bit to us.
Yeah. So the big difference between 5G and 4G is they're completely different. So the most important thing I would want people to get out of this short video is don't assume that because it's called 5G, it's like 4G except faster. That's the mistake everybody makes. In 4G, you know, your phone is your phone. It's a phone. The network that handles your phone is like a switching network, right? More advanced, but same thing. In 5G, everything is a compute device. Your phone is not a phone. It's actually a computer that's running a program called phone to allow you as a human being to interact with it with a dial pad. The network itself is completely software defined, how it routes the call, where it does the call processing. So the good news about 5G is it's very powerful. It's actually a programming language. You can move the modules, the software modules around in a 5G network from the edge to the RAN to the core to the MEC node, right? And it gives you huge flexibility. You can actually create services in 5G for smart transportation or autonomous cars or entertainment systems. The downside is all this flexibility is introducing huge new vulnerabilities and risks into our communication system that we were never designed for. So if you just think about, let's start with something very simple. Here's your phone and you talk to it, right? In a 5G network, someone can add software or change software on your phone, which is, this is a feature of 5G, right? So all of a sudden someone could turn your phone into a speakerphone and you wouldn't know that, right? Or the other thing that happens in 5G is when two people are talking, if we're talking on a 5G call, there's actually a data path between your phone and my phone. And some of the packets are voice, but some of the packets are control packets. So, you know, you can do funky things with 5G phones that don't exist in 4G, like you could have one phone take over another phone. Now, this wasn't done in a meme purpose. This was all done in the future IoT context, where you might have smart transportation systems and you're pushing forward software and you want to create auto updates. These are all good reasons, right? But you can understand from a national security risk perspective, this whole host of new features has shown up on the shores of America. And really, we're not prepared to understand it. We're not prepared to kind of manage it. And it's kind of caught us off guard. And, so this is where everybody on the national security side has to really, you know, look at this and do a lot of things, expand the risk models, change procurement, look at software much more critically. If you remember the SolarWinds attack, it was pretty bad. Now imagine the SolarWinds attack on everybody's phone in America. it'd be kind of devastating. Yeah.
So Junaid, the net of SolarWinds was we don't really look at logs. So now this big observability buzzword is where we've got to continuously monitor everything, which is kind of part of the five pillars of zero trust. So could you maybe explain, like, do we have to get really quick up to speed on zero trust before we can make 5G work, or is it a parallel effort? Or
yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think zero trust gives us a great model, right? And the most important thing in the word zero trust let's start with the word zero trust, right? So zero trust basically says is if you have something like your phone, you need to not trust it. Because unlike, let's think about phones from 60 years ago, the cable, right? At least you know exactly what it was doing. And yeah, someone could tap the line, but you know, it was within boundary of, okay, the only attack is someone tapping my phone line. With 5G, someone can redefine what your phone is into something totally different. I mean, they can turn it into a surveillance system. So this notion of zero trust is actually a useful both mental and security framework for everybody to adopt, right? So for example, in the classic DoD approach to vendor procurement or supply chain risk, we will look at the vendors, you know, make sure they're not foreign companies, look at the people, give them security clearance, right? What we find is now with 5G, we have to extend that model. So maybe somebody that you know and love, you know, who has been a friend for decades, he's doing something. But because 5G has all these software blocks coming from a global supply chain, maybe somebody infiltrated the supply chain 10 or 20 companies down. And now that person you trust, that you know, is actually using a block of code that's been infiltrated. Now having this notion of zero trust, which is, okay, we can't trust anything, even if we trust the people. Then the question says, what kind of automated systems do we put in, right? Systems to look for modifications in code. So an example there is taking the hash of the libraries that developers do, and then keeping a copy of the hash so that when you use that software, it's exactly what the developers gave you. Because by the time someone writes a piece of code, even if they're fully cleared as a DoD vendor, right? By the time that code bounces around and gets in a tactical system, you know, there's many places where the code could get swapped, right? And, you know, so we have to think about risk in a much deeper, broader perspective because these 5G systems use a lot more software. Moreover, 5G is designed from scratch to update software. It's one of the features of 5G. You know, you don't have to like, you know, like as Marv knows, bring a ship back to port and take 2 years to freight it. With 5G, you can do really clever things, but that also introduces risk. So to your question, Jim, I think zero trust is a good philosophical model, which is, and it's not about people. It's not saying, hey, we don't trust American vendors and all this other stuff. We're saying the system complexity is so high that even people you trust, they could be infiltrated and not knowing it. So we need a zero trust architecture that's looking at all of the software components in our system on a nationwide basis and is able to verify.
We haven't talked about this, but you're making me think about it. So why don't we control all this software that's part of 5G through some kind of a authorized blockchain system where you keep everything in these hashed blocks?
So that's an idea that a lot of people have been thinking about. I mean, they've been thinking about this for a few years. And I think the silver lining of the SolarWinds attack is people realized, hey, maybe this, and this old idea of basically tested software, now people are realizing, hey, maybe this is being important. And if anything, I think the DoD, this is something the DoD can do. It's relatively inexpensive. It's actually a relatively inexpensive idea, which is all the DoD vendors, wherever they are, they take hashes of their code, and then we put it on a blockchain, and then you run agents in anything, your Navy ship, your airplane, and it checks the inventory. And the beauty is, people might say, are we disclosing something classified? And the answer is no, it's just the hashes. The hash doesn't say what it is. It doesn't say it's a satellite imaging system or it's on a fighter plane or this is just a radio for a soldier, right? It's basically a big set of numbers with another set of numbers. And then the other thing you want to do is replicate this hash library around the world. So, you know, if you're on a Navy ship, they can just verify very quickly whether the software is there. And because this is a such lightweight process, I would say let the agents run all the time. And, you know, because, you know, I mean, yes, you know, computational systems go up and down. So during quiet periods or nighttime or when they're out of service, they can be scanning all the code because there's always the opportunity for foreign agents to basically swap or replace code, right?
Yeah, so go back, you know, but 14 years, I consulted for Fortify, and they couldn't get anybody in defense to scan source code. So they were smart. They went to Congress and got it written in congressional law. So here we are 14 years later. And now the challenge is, yeah, it's great to scan source code once or twice or every year. But now this new idea of observability is you have application performance monitoring, and you put snippets of code in the application code so you can actually monitor the application while it's running. But that's a culture shock to, like, you know, I'm going to monitor GCCS while it's sitting on the USS Roosevelt and I can tell when, you know, the database is down. So I think it's, you know, and again, this observability buzzword is still catching on. There's, you know, there's a company called Observe.inc that started. There's Splunk doing it now, Elastic's doing it. So it'll be interesting, you know, if they understand you've got to actually monitor the app, because the old days we still just, oh, we're going to monitor logs.
And so is that the replacement for continuous monitoring?
It's a subset of, you know, observability is logs plus metrics plus application performance monitoring, but it's the idea that you're just not monitoring the network traffic or monitoring the system logs, but you're actually monitoring the actual application, and you can see when there's an anomaly in some applications running and suddenly it does weird things, right? So it must, maybe has malware or something introduced to it. But again, that's a culture shock site, because I still go into programs and are like, oh, we ran Fortify 6 months ago. So it's, we're all good.
Well, so this is a great example of zero trust, the philosophy, right? You could say in the past, we used to do an annual security review, or we used to do a vendor review, make sure the vendor's good and the people have security clearance, right? But now in this world of very complex software, this person you love and trust, their software could have been swapped and they don't even know, right? Moreover, or it comes all the way to a Navy ship and then it gets swapped by somebody else, right? So if you say, well, you know, we could have a cyber attack anytime from anybody, then we say, well, why don't we adopt a zero trust architecture? And what does that really mean? It means constant revaluation. So the way we calibrate and monitor our systems is different, right? So we need to move to an environment of continuous monitoring of the whole stack, looking at not only the classic cyber attacks of, say, credential theft, you know, somebody pretending to be somebody else and coming in, to newer lateral moving malware, which is how Russia attacked Ukraine in 2017. It's also how Iran attacked Saudi Arabia in 2017. And, you know, to look at these connections that are coming from nowhere, going to nowhere, to what we're just discussing. Well, now we actually have a global supply chain problem, right? Where, you know, our code is so complex and we're using libraries, and maybe the library is good at one instant in time, but someone changes the library, right? And now this is like very tricky, right?
Yeah, I use SolarWinds for my security and I must trust it's good.
That's right. Yeah.
So Junaid, relative to your point about the things that need to be done about this, what is being done? Is the national security community embracing any of this and actually trying to change the paradigm rather than just trust in Verizon and AT&T?
I think everybody is thinking about this, which is good. I think the recent cyber attacks, at Colonial Pipeline were an example of how something relatively simple like a ransomware can create national scale problems. My hope is that at the national security level, we do start making some changes, as both of you know well. The DoD and the intelligence community are gigantic bureaucracies, and they're going to have to institutionalize not just cybersecurity, but I would say technology. I mean, part of the problem is we're just talking about 5G. People don't understand the technologies. And if you don't understand the technologies, like in the sense that 5G is a programming environment, it's very hard to understand the security risk and then what to do with it, right? So we're seeing this as a symptomatic issue. I mean, let me just pick a random topic, quantum computing, right? I mean, is it a threat to America? Is it an asset? You know, and what you find is it's both, depending on how much effort we put into it. So I think we need to do more in terms of security, but not security in the classic sense of let's go buy a security product. We need to do more in terms of rethinking how do we build these big systems. It's an architectural issue. So one of the reasons NIST called it a zero trust architecture versus zero trust security, the NIST people were 100% correct. It's actually the architecture, right? So that means you are secure by default or secure by design, right? That means, you know, how is the whole architecture built? Having all the security, let's just talk in a Navy ship context. If the whole Navy system, if on a ship, the weapons control system and the imaging are all intermixed, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if one system is secure, it's connecting to all of the other systems, right? So how you think about it, the security has to be integrated in, the architecture has to be secure, then the blocks of code need to be secure. And this is where I think it's great the leadership at the national security level is looking at this, but we now need to start doing this. And I think that's a long way to go still.
Can you comment? So like we're involved in some DevSecOps, right? The idea of go fast, you know, we can't wait 8 years to build a system. So the idea of microservices and putting everything in Kubernetes containers. But then part of that whole DevSecOps is, again, continuous monitoring. But it's like, and they've, you know, on a positive, they've gone from RMF to this idea of continuous ATO. But again, the challenge of, you know, am I really going to connect to that Joint Strike Fighter and upload software in real time without, you know, the old traditional, I'm going to test it for 2 or 3 weeks or a month, you know, and maybe comment on what, you know, do you think the culture will change where we do trust a software upload to a major combat system or weapon?
Well, I think that's a great topic. So I think just using zero trust, you know, zero trust, really the way we think about it today is as a network technology, and there's great companies like Palo Alto and Zscaler doing it, but we have a new wave of zero trust companies who are focusing on APIs and data. So there's a company called Corsha, which is doing API-based zero trust for the Air Force. And there's another company called XQMessage, which is doing zero trust data protection, where they take a block of data and they wrap it in a meta tag. So the good news is there are a portfolio of new tools, zero trust tools coming out. The tricky part is basically merging, adopting those in an organization as large and complex as DoD. And that I would say is a leadership issue. And I say that in a good way, not in a mean way. There's a lot of pressure if you're an admiral or general. You got like an infinitely long to-do list. So having like one other item is kind of stressful, right? But having said that, I think technology and cybersecurity, deserve a spot at the weekly national security briefing. I think it's become that important. We as an American are a technology-based society now, and I think it, it's risen to that level. It should just be a standing item at the national security call.
But Janae, do you know, you and I both know from our previous experiences the frustration with how do you get a leader to understand enough about what the technology and the challenges are to actually try solutions, because they're bombarded by 1,000 solutions every day or every week, and everyone says the same thing: we got the answer, just trust us and buy it. And so they have a hard time deciding who to trust in their cybersecurity chain. And then even in the cybersecurity chain, we have turned it into a cottage industry. So a lot of the people in the cybersecurity chain don't have very much knowledge either. So we get overwhelmed by complexity, in my opinion, and it makes people have a hard time to make decisions about it.
So I think you've actually touched on an interesting topic, which is one that I've experienced personally. And that is technology. Really in the past has never been first a career path at the DoD. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the career path at the DoD is all at the warfighting level. And I mean, that makes total sense, right? But as technology becomes a part of warfighting, what happens is most of the senior leadership, and they're all great people, they're all American heroes, aren't really experts in technology. And this is very tricky for them. Right. And some of these things require knowledge that takes 10 or 20 years to gain. I've been in meetings, which I think you're kind of like hinting at, you know, where you meet somebody very important, you know, and, you know, they call together experts. And I've been a few of these meetings, and I know others have been. And the meeting is always the same, where, you know, first this extremely important person thanks all us technical people for their decades of service. And then they say, well, what's this topic? And we start talking about something like quantum computing, and it goes well. And then we start talking about entanglement, or you talk about hypersonics, and then you talk about material sciences, or you start talking about 5G. And then you talk about the complexities of RF interference joining in military millimeter wave calibration. And always the important person at some point of the meeting, I've been through this, will look back and say, that's a lot to think about. I'd like to thank everybody who's in this briefing to provide this valuable information. So at that point, you know that you kind of lost them, right? But so I think you know, DoD has to take a hard look and the intelligence community and say, you know, they created some of this problem. They didn't create a career path for purely technical people. You know, I mean, if you just think about the ranks, there's not a career path for someone to, you know, who might have started as an installer on secure comms to stay within the architecture and rise to a senior rank, to become a general, an admiral, to become the director of the CIA. That career path doesn't exist. And we as a country are now facing issues that have a big technology component, where you have to understand a lot about material sciences before you understand, is hypersonics feasible or not? You have to understand a lot about physics before you can make a judgment on, should we burn a couple billion on quantum computing or not? You have to understand a lot about communications to understand, how do we connect warships to fighters to submarines and do these techniques. I mean, these aren't trivial decisions. These are require a lot of depth. And I think the DoD needs to take a hard look at attracting engineers and then keeping them for the 20 years it takes to groom a general. I mean, it really takes that long to groom somebody, right? And you can't have somebody drop out after 3 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to work somewhere else.
Yeah, like in the Navy, the engineering, the career path needs to be less acquisition centric and maybe more technical, right? And I think it's going to be even more amplified with AI, ML, and, you know, who pushes the button to a hypersonic threat? It's not, humans not going to be involved anymore.
Yeah.
It's going to be an algorithm. So,
so an interesting comment about what you're saying, Junaid, is we do have an example in our history where we created a technical career path around a very serious problem. That's nuclear power to power submarines and ships. And it was done primarily because Hyman Rickover was the officer who started that whole culture. And he was dedicated enough to spend his entire career in the culture. And Congress was smart enough to make sure he stayed in that culture to continue to shepherd it. So right up until he was in his 80s with Alzheimer's, he was still in the Navy as a Navy admiral. But he literally created the career path of people that could understand nuclear power, run nuclear power plants, and make sure that nothing happened. And the net result is, if you look into the records, the submarines in the Soviet Navy have had a large number of very serious nuclear accidents, and we've had no serious nuclear accidents. But how do you recreate that in this new world without finding some new 5G cybersecurity person that's going to carry those reins forward? That's a tough cultural challenge, and I think you're right on, though.
Well, I think we have no choice. We have to create a career path now where the DoD gets people in at the age of 20, trains them. I mean, I was fortunate that I got trained more than 30 years ago. And I benefited that for my whole life. But in my case, there clearly wasn't a career path and I went somewhere else, right? They have to do the opposite. They got to get young people. And the great thing is young people are excited to join the service today, but then they get kind of disenchanted and leave. While they're excited, train them, let them do things, let them create 5G networks, and then give them a career path to become a captain and create those career paths so they can become a general or an admiral or the head of an intelligence. That is, I think what you said about the nuclear power plants in submarines is 100% spot on. The reason the United States has a fantastic boomer fleet is people. It's not the contractors. It's not the defense contractors. It's all about the people who have stayed with nuclear submarines decade after decade. And having been involved in technology, I can tell you right now, it's the people, right? You can have whatever whiz bang, whatever. If you don't have the people who understand it, understand how to use it appropriately, but also understand how not to use it, understand the limitations. You know, we're talking about things like networked tactical warfare systems. Jim just mentioned, and you also mentioned machine learning, right? Machine learning can be fantastic for target acquisition, but in the wrong hands, you know what? It's going to kill the wrong people very quickly, us, right? So it takes a long time to understand machine learning. It takes a long time to understand how the coefficients in the algorithm can change the decision-making. Then when you add the complexity that this is actually connected to a targeting system, you know, that's kind of terrifying, right? And it takes decades to build that experience. So I hope that DoD will take this to heart. You know, I'm again realistic that this is just a webinar, but really do the right thing for the young people in their 20s. And then as they mature through the system, then that'll have the right effect on procurement, because the DoD contractors will have someone who's their equal or greater, right? Right now, the DoD contracts, again, great people, and I'm sure you've been in meetings where the person in uniform is nervous about arguing with the defense contractor, right? Because they're talking about these technologies and that, you know, people in uniform are very polite. So they're sitting and smiling, right? But they won't ask questions, right? And that's only going to happen with someone who's been there for decades, been trained, had that experience. So I think, if anything, I think DoD should take this new technology heavy, cyber heavy direction we're going in, and really, you know, get these people in their 20s as they graduate, also get grad students, PhD students, and give them a career path. I think that's the most important thing.
So we are getting along towards our 30 minutes. I don't know if Jim's got other questions. I was going to let you maybe wrap up some of your thoughts by thinking through, if you really had the ear of the current Biden administration in these areas, what would you recommend that they do that could be done on a timeline that an administration can actually start to make a dent in it? Because we all know Washington runs on administration time more than time.
So I think the best thing we could do, which will cost taxpayers nothing and help America, is get people to talk. Right now, all the technology discussions at DoD are treated like weapons procurement. You're on a base and you need, let's not do that. Let's get people in uniform out of the base, talking to startups, talking to big companies, little companies, talking to inventors, talking to professors. If there's one thing Americans love, they love seeing people in uniform. They just get a kick out of it. They just do, right? I mean, everybody knows that. They just love seeing people who've just joined the service. Take advantage, push them out there into the world. Just get them talking. I think that'll help a lot, because then it's not a procurement decision, or it's not, you know, it's just like, just talk to people. And there's startups everywhere that have new ideas. Don't make it a procurement. Send them over. Send them out of the base, you know, and talk to them. What did you invent? Can you show me? You got a new battery? Show me. So one, DoD has to change its posture. When you get to, you know, what could the White House do and DoD do together, I think we need to create more small experiments that are about learning, that are more in the $2 to $4 million size, not $100 or $1 billion procurements, where we find somebody who's invented a new kind of millimeter radio. Great, let's give them $2 million and say, part of that $2 million, you got to train these people in uniform on your system for better or worse. And then you guys in uniform who just learned this, you're going to work with this other team with what you learned. And now you're going to do something. So we have to get that going, right? Because we need people who have that knowledge. And then the other thing I would ask the White House to think about is just what we discussed, that the White House has the capability in coordination with the Department of Defense to now create a career path. And, you know, they should mandate the first general, our first technologist general. So, and, you know, create that position now and let's fill it in a decade. And now let's shortlist 10,000 young people and tell one of those 10, you among the first 10,000 will be America's first DoD general CTO, general of technology, right? Something like that, where I think the White House can easily do that. The other things the White House doing is good, like the stimulus. And obviously there's a lot of people working on that. So I think, I don't want to add any comments there, but I think on the people side, I think the DoD can do something the White House can do stuff very quickly that can make a lot of changes.
Well, I hope that that's what happens, because it certainly needs to happen quickly if we're going to start to turn this around, because we do have probably more national security challenges now than we've seen in a long time. And clearly the Chinese are very dedicated to taking their place on the hierarchy of countries in the world. And so we're going to all be watching to see where that goes. Any last comments, Jim?
No, I'm good. I really appreciate the discussion, and probably we'll have some more follow-ons with you, Jane.
Great. No, thanks. Thanks for having me, and hope this is useful.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks.